I'm Andy Marshall. I am the Managing Director of the Georgia Cleantech Innovation Hub, and I will be moderating today's panel. Very excited to get that started. But before we start, I want to do a couple things. One, I wanted to thank Technology Association of Georgia for hosting our co-hosting this event with us, as well as the Clubhouse at Tech Square for giving us a nice room to gather as a panel. And again, so this panel is brought together to talk about a thought piece that our organization, the Cleantech Innovation Hub, put out at the end of last year. And as I mentioned in that, in promoting that, one of the most important things I feel about these pieces is the conversations that they create. And this will be one of those. But then again, given we're on, you know, this is January 30th, and I have just started telling everybody happy New Year. So we're almost at that time where outlooks, we need to start turning into action. So hopefully this conversation here, again, sparks others, but then also helps lead us into action for the rest of 2024. So we will get started with introductions now. I'm going to start going around to my left. I'll let Cynthia Curry take it away.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Cynthia Curry, Metro Atlanta Chamber. I'm on the economic development team there, and I build up the smart cities ecosystem. So love all the people at this table, and thanks to TAG for all they do, and thanks to the Clubhouse for having us.
Yep. Good to be with the panel. My name is Prasanna Venkatesan. I run mergers and acquisitions for Landis & Gyr. We're a publicly listed company in Switzerland, but our North American headquarters is in Atlanta, Georgia.
Hey everybody, Evan Pittman. I'm a managing director at Energy Impact Partners. We're a global venture capital and private equity investment firm focused on energy transition. I have about $4 billion in assets under management. But what really sets EIP apart in the market is that we're backed by a global coalition of about 70 corporates who have their own net zero and sustainability and innovation objectives. Large portion of those are the North American investor-owned utility industry. About half of the North American IOUs participate in our funds, and we work closely with our corporate partners to develop our theses on how the markets are developing, vet investments together, and then most importantly, scale up new clean energy technologies together. Our headquarters is in New York, but I'm based here in Atlanta, along with a few colleagues who run our Elevate Future Fund that's focused on supporting diverse founders in the energy transition. Great to be with you all. And thanks to the Georgia Clean Tech Hub and TAG for having me here.
Thanks. Hi there. I'm Michael Oxman. I'm the managing director of the Racy Anderson Center for Sustainable Business at Scheller College of Business at Georgia Tech. And our center is focused on infusing sustainability into business through business education and practice. So we have, you know, sort of three major channels of activity. Education, the courses and co-curricular activities that we put on. We have research and both within the College of Business as well as across Georgia Tech that affiliate with our center. And then we have our corporate engagement, which really attempts to try and connect the dots both with our researchers as well as with our students. And I'll be talking a little bit more about one of our larger initiatives. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Miguel Grande. I'm founder and managing director of Invested Development. We're a small private venture capital fund that's focused on clean energy and agriculture for over a decade now. And I'm also been involved from the early days with the Georgia Cleantech Innovation Hub and trying to get that launched. So I'm happy to be here.
Fantastic. Thank you, guys. Hopefully all the panel, hopefully everyone who's joining can see we have a very dynamic group of panelists today, mainly because we have a very dynamic and broad topic to talk about, which is cleantech innovation and an outlook for 2024. I like to keep these things pretty conversational, guys, so we can all look around the table. But I like to start with a little bit of a quick hitter for everybody, and I might pick somebody to go on this one first. So look, we're obviously looking forward, but let's look back at 2023. So if you look back at 2023 and think of all the things that happened in clean tech, is there a stat that you think just jumps out that would really put in context where we're starting from here? And maybe I'll go with Evan. He looks like he wants to start.
All right. 5.5 gigawatt hours. That's my stat, Andy. Okay. Top of mind for me because that is the volume of firm commercial commitments that our portfolio company Form received in 2023. Form's developed a breakthrough iron air battery chemistry that delivers 100 hour duration storage to the grid at remarkably low cost compared to lithium ion. And just to give folks kind of a baseline, prior to 2023, there was about 11 gigawatt hours of total battery energy storage deployed on the grid, period. So met about 50% of the historical build out, which to me is just a fantastic testament to the success of Form, but more importantly, a signal that there's real demand out there materializing from off-takers and corporates for clean energy solutions right now.
Yeah, that's amazing. Real from the context standpoint, I started in energy storage, my career in energy storage. We were back then fighting for 250 megawatts, and that was a big deal. Scale and context is everything.
And I guess just to make the local connection, about a gigawatt and a half hour of, or so of those hours were committed right here in Georgia by Georgia Power. Southern Company is a partner to one of the lead investors in Energy Impact Partners. So delighted for that to have an impact here in Georgia too.
Maybe a theme for 2025. Indeed. Prasanna. Would you like to go next?
Yes, I'll keep along the energy theme. So last year in our country, one out of three vehicles sold in the passenger car business was EV. A lot of people think that this trend kind of slowed down last year with a number of reasons for it. You know, the slowdown in the economy plus getting raw materials into the country was a bit of a difficulty, but this industry is on the rise. That's 33%. So 15 million passenger cars are produced in the US. So one in three is going to be EV. But if you look back, the adoption rates was just 7% in 2021.
Yeah.
So we're clearly on the right trajectory. Everybody recognizes the importance of it. I think the prices that, you know, when yesterday Tesla announced a few changes and how to get the price point down such that it's not just a rich man's game.
Yeah.
And it becomes commonplace everywhere is the next big challenge. And the other thing is the charging stations are getting built up in pretty rapid fashion. We actually deployed quite a bit of DC fast charging in the country last year, as well as AC charging is on the rise. Yeah.
It's fantastic. Yeah, I can't wait till one third of the cars that are sold are used cars that are sold are also EVs. That'll be an awesome milestone to hit too. Head over to Miguel. Miguel, what do you think?
Relating to both of those, is we finally started to see money coming out from the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, and that's what it brought. So a total $110 billion of investment that was triggered by the IRA in over 2023 stimulated almost 100,000 jobs that were created in that. And a lot of it is building out charging infrastructure, building out storage infrastructure, and also going towards the grid. So that's an incredible stat, and I think one that we're going to see continue to ramp up, in particular in 2024, which probably will be the most exciting year.
Yeah. So a little bit of the what happened, and a little bit of the why. Let's shift to Cynthia. What do you think, Cynthia?
Yeah, I'll drill down on Miguel's stat. I mean, $100 billion across the U.S., but Georgia was the number one state for clean energy manufacturing investment in the whole United States, with over $18 billion being invested here and over 16,000 jobs. So I think that I'm excited that Georgia's leaning in and making the world better and creating the jobs of tomorrow, and that people are finally recognizing that we have the diversity of energy and the startup innovation power and the corporate power and the collaboration, which I think is the biggest piece to make it all work here. So that's my favorite stat of the year.
So Georgia's number one too, right?
Number one.
This is
best state to do business for 8 years in a row. Yeah.
That's amazing. Michael, last but not least, what's your stat for 2023?
Well, I was going to actually, I think mine parallels your stat, Cynthia. One of them is that, we had the largest number of announcements of clean energy investments in the state in 2023. The other one, which I have to share because I'm very excited about it, is that we have I mentioned earlier, we have a range of corporate initiatives, and the biggest one that we're working on right now is called the Drawdown Georgia Business Compact, which I'll be talking more about. But essentially, it is a consortium of companies, 63 of them, that's the stat I was getting to, that are working together to collaborate on clean energy and climate reduction mitigation solutions for the state of Georgia.
Amazing.
So Georgia's number one, and we have a lot of companies jumping on to do something about it. So that's fantastic. I think that's a great summary for 2023. Now, like I said, this is an outlook for 2024. So our outlook was structured around five key themes, right? So starting with collaboration at scale, we had announcement to production. We heard a little bit about announcements, number one for announcements as well. We'll talk a little bit about what that means. Innovation at the grid edge was another theme, through cycle investing. And then lastly, it was alternative funding mechanisms. So we're going to hit on all of those, but I'm going to start with collaboration at scale and we'll talk to Michael a little bit about that. So we all know that greenhouse gas reduction efforts require collaboration because no one company controls their whole emissions portfolio, right? So the other thing I think we're starting to see is that some companies actually compete a little bit on how green they are, right? And what they're doing. And this can be actually be a competitive advantage in some cases. That might seem like it flies in the face of collaboration. But what I'd love you to talk a little bit about, and you just mentioned it, is Drawdown Georgia Business Compact and the number of companies that you're bringing on. So we did highlight that in the piece. And I'd love you to talk a little bit more for the folks who don't know about it. Tell us a little bit more about what you guys do.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. The Drawdown Georgia Business Compact was built on a foundation of research. It was a multi-university collaboration between Georgia Tech, Emory, University of Georgia and Georgia State. And in that research, we identified the 20 highest impact solutions for the state of Georgia, you know, inspired by Project Drawdown, if y'all are familiar with Paul Hawkins' work, which had the top 100 global solutions. So after the research was completed and we had this sort of roadmap of different types of solutions, as a business school, it came to us, well, how do we leverage the research that's been done and how do we actually move the needle on with action? Mm-hmm. And so the idea of the Drawdown Georgia Business Compact was born. A bit of an experiment, and so far we're happy with the results. You build it and they will come. Mm-hmm. And so far folks have showed up. We're very happy about that. And the idea is not only to reduce emissions in the state, but also to support economic development, jobs, equity. Mm-hmm. And these are all infused in the various conversations we're having with these compact members. The first thing we did is we wanted to make sure that we had a diversity of members as part of the compact. And by diversity, we included, for example, leaders, you know, companies that are already doing innovative things in this space. And I'll just give you a couple of examples of some of our members. We had Kia as a member, mm-hmm. and they've invested heavily in EV expansion in the state. Stryten Energy is a member, and they have Georgia's first vanadium flow battery in the state, and they've partnered with one of the EMCs here to do that. And then we have Google as one of the members as well, and they of course have enormous data center needs. And then finally, I'll mention Pirelli, which has partnered with the Ray. Mm-hmm. And if you're not familiar with the Ray, it's also a play on Ray C. Anderson. Mm-hmm. They're a nonprofit that's essentially trying to create a decarbonized highway, a net zero highway in Georgia. So now what are we doing? Well, we don't want this to be, this is not a public relations exercise. I mean, yeah. It's great if companies are getting public relations benefits out of this, but we want action. Yeah. So we're framing this across four areas or activity areas. Mm-hmm. And I'll try to go through these quickly. And feel free to interrupt me.
I'm not going to, but I will add, there's a few points that you've really brought on that I think actually tie in with a lot of stuff we're talking about. So
great. Yeah. Well, the first activity area is facilitating collaborations. Cynthia's point, I mean, there is just so much opportunity for collaboration in identifying the leaders, the folks that are doing, that have, you know, ambitious decarbonization goals. Many of them don't know how they're going to get that last mile, right? Mm-hmm. And so collaboration is a critical part of this. And we're trying to find where those, you know, sort of intersections are. Mm-hmm. So a few examples, we've created some work groups within the compact, and there's a few initiatives that have emerged out of that. One is we're looking at creating a forest carbon market in the state of Georgia. Mm-hmm. The idea being that you have the potential for companies in the state to invest in offsets that they might otherwise invest in emerging markets. Let's get some of those offsets here, some of that investment here at home in the state of Georgia, and at the same time benefit some of the local farmers who have not typically been at the table. Mm-hmm. And we're in addition to the companies that are interested in this, we're engaged with the Georgia Forestry Foundation and a number of others on that. So that's one initiative. Another one is we have a group that's focused on energy, and they're interested in looking at the opportunity for collective procurement as a way to bring on renewable energy even faster in the state. So that's also super exciting, and we've had some really interesting strategies that are coming out of that, which I can talk more about later. One last example is renewable natural gas as a bridge to decarbonization, but specifically trying to get it, you know, get the industrial emissions down, the natural gas, the virgin natural gas, if you will, down, and use renewable to displace it. The second activity area is innovation, is catalyzing innovation. And fortunately, we have great partners like the two of you and you and anybody else who wants to be, you know, we're really excited about the things that are happening in this space. Some of the things that we're doing there within the compact is we're now working on tying this to employee-based innovation. So how can companies engage their employees in carbon reduction activities? And we already, that's leveraging some things we already do at Georgia Tech within our, that we run through our center and with other partners on campus. Interns go to companies, and it doesn't, they don't have to be focused on sustainability, but they are interested in adding this to whatever their internship responsibilities are. And they identify, you know, carbon savings opportunities. We have a nice competition. So we're trying to bridge, we're going to bring that out to the companies that are in the compact so that they can have more engagement around their carbon emissions and other sustainability ideas. We have something called Sustainable X, which is a sort of a, it builds off of an existing platform at Georgia Tech called CreateX. And this is an opportunity for students and others to work to work on, you know, startups, create startups, and with mentorship and guidance. And what Sustainable X does is it gives them resources to focus squarely on sustainability. And so that's a relatively new program that we're super excited about.
So Michael, real quick. Mm-hmm. So I think that some of the things you've gotten right at Drawdown, one is the groups of companies, right? I don't think it's just big. It's not just the big companies, not just the leaders, right? I think it stretches all the way down, and it also stretches broad across, right? So
indeed,
because clean tech, like the buyers in clean tech, especially stretch in Georgia, stretch across a wide range of industries, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you got that. You've definitely gotten that right. And then I love the themes, right? The, you know, innovation and the really one I love is the collective action. The, you know, can we get scale through, you know, bringing together companies who are trying to do the exact same thing. Again, this is things that one company can't do alone well, but as a group can do really well. The procurement and that forest carbon pieces are fantastic. I do want to shift to Cynthia for a second, just because I think there's some threads you can pull on in there as well. So Cynthia, you're the great collaborator. Mm-hmm. And you often talked about collaboration being Georgia's superpower. So I'd love to talk a little bit about at the chamber, what you guys do to drive, you know, from the collaboration side to drive economic development in the state.
Yeah, I do truly believe that collaboration is our superpower, and that we hear it all the time from other companies and organizations and countries that come and visit us, that people don't all play nicely like we do in Georgia. So it's a huge bonus. And I will say, just to plug on the Sustainability X, out of CreateX, there have been several unicorns. So fingers crossed that we'll get several unicorns coming out of the Sustainability X.
2025.
How many Sustainability X unicorns? But I'll say that really at the chamber, we're just really trying to unleash everyone's ambition, right? Everyone in Atlanta is doing so many wonderful things, and Georgia is doing so many wonderful things. And we act as a guide, right, to help unleash what everyone else can do, make sure that they have the resources and the support that they need, and can get in touch with the grants and the incentives and meet the partners that they want. So we're here. I always joke that I'm kind of like a Sherpa, that kind of evangelizing the work that everyone else is doing. But there are so many amazing organizations that do the same thing. And I think that that's why collaboration at scale in the clean tech space is working in Atlanta. We have the ARC, we have the Atlanta Regional Commission, and they're doing amazing work developing electrification, transportation plans for the next 5 to 7 years. I'm helping do that. They're setting climate goals. We just launched a new council to do that. For the next 5 to 7 years, what are some of the main ways that we can decarbonize over the 22 county area? And I will mention, we are Metro Atlanta Chamber, we're 29 counties. AR oversees 2 counties, so it's not just City of Atlanta, and we're for all of Georgia. I mean, rising tide raises all boats, and Georgia's really killing it on that. South Face is an amazing collaborative organization that helps people scale. I mean, the work that James Marlowe is doing to help make sure that policies are in place that we need to have a business-friendly economic development kind of structure and make sure that everything is for the good of the people. James is excellent at making sure that that happens. We have City of Atlanta that's doing great things from everything from clean tech is not just, it's about equity, right? So, you know, housing for the unhoused and getting digital access to people. I mean, those are all parts of this clean tech journey, and City of Atlanta is doing a lot with that. Someone mentioned Curiosity Lab, one of the greatest jewels of Georgia, kind of leaning into e-mobility solutions and clean tech solutions around transportation. And they have such involvement with corporates and startups, kind of doing projects and pilot projects all around the Curiosity Lab. So they are a huge example of collaboration in the region. The Ray, you mentioned the Ray. Allie Kelly is one of the most brilliant women on the planet. And she started doing this work to reach zero deaths and zero net emission just in Georgia. And now she's working with over 15 states with the Department of Transportation across. She's doing solar work in right-of-way highways. She's doing incredible work, the whole Pirelli project where they're using the old tires to shred them up and put them in the asphalt to make the ecosystem better and make the rainwater better and cleaner as it goes on the flowers, and then it helps the car run better. It's just a huge, it's a collaborative scale like none other. So Drawdown Georgia.
Yeah, so we'll draw down Georgia. So what I get, I mean, the way I often think about Mac, and I think you hit on it, is Mac has got, I mean, they make sense of the alphabet soup, I think, in economic development, right? I mean, I know where to go if I need any help in clean tech, and you point me in, you can point me in the right direction. And then I also think you do that for everybody, right? I think that's, I mean, that's an overly simplified view of Mac, I know. But I feel like that's it.
Yeah, we connect people. Yeah, we're the connectors. Yeah. And we try to help make everyone sing from the same page and know what everyone else is doing so that we can all help one another.
Yeah, I love the community that you're trying to create as Thank it relates you. To clean tech. And there's some further engagement with our Strategic Energy Institute around that.
Yes, they're on my list. Strategic Energy Institute, Georgia Tech, Tim Lewin, 1,000 plus people working on energy solutions. Amazing. Thank you. They were on my list and I did not say them. Thank you.
We're gonna come back because there may be something I overlooked here. It's one of my questions at the end.
But if we could just I mean, one of the key things we'll say is Georgia is a corporate town. I think
corporate headquarters.
So and that's a key part is that for any of these solutions and innovations to scale, this is a great place to be because you have your buyers or your collaborators there, but you got to get to them. And it's not easy to just walk up to the head of a Fortune 500 company. Yeah. And so what the Mac does is provide those routes for innovators to come up, for startups, for founders, for collaborators to come up and find those corporate headquarters, the people in charge of the corporate headquarters that need to be talked to. And that is an absolute critical component for the stalwart.
Yeah, we've got a very good student population here as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Has resources, which is one of the biggest problems that clean tech will face, if you know.
Miguel hits on
raising population.
Miguel hits on a great point there. Sorry, Prasanna. We at EIP, we think one of the big mistakes of CleanTech 1.0, and for those listening, I know there's a lot of students on the line, they haven't been paying attention to the clean tech world in 2008 to 2011, but that's the surge in, solar innovations and a number of other clean technology innovations that, let's just say, as a portfolio, did not return so well for their investors. We think one of the big mistakes there was not being collaborative with the corporates and the incumbent energy asset operators. They took in sort of Silicon Valley fashion a very let's disrupt model. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's very hard to disrupt an industry that spent 100 years pouring trillions of dollars into building very long-lived assets that still provide a lot of value to customers.
Yeah.
So I think we've found part of the success of this EIP model, and the reason we've gotten those 70 corporates on board and so many of those utilities is because the utilities are hungry to work with the innovators. They're not threatened. They see a lot of collaboration opportunity. Utilities are not R&D shops, right? They're not inventing new technology. They want to provide clean, reliable, affordable energy to their customers, and they know they need new tech to do it. So I think getting, you know, taking that collaborative attitude with the corporates is so important, especially in this sector.
That's perfect. And you that was, it's a great segue, actually, because I actually wanted to pivot right into innovation. We have an innovation piece in here too, right? So talk about innovation. The grid edge is one of mine. And this is, again, this is a topic that's pretty near and dear to my heart. I only spent the first 10 years of my career in the grid edge. But I'm going to pivot this one to Prasanna. So the grid edge, again, has come to mean a lot of things, fully encompassing. And again, I'm an insider, and I think that I'd love you as an expert to sort of tell a little bit, you know, give your definition of that and explain what it means to you.
Well, listen, there was a lot of conversation already touched upon it. I want to start with what you said. So if you look at electric utilities, which is where this term got defined, they've been around for 100 years, you know, always invested in this country pretty heavily in terms of assets. If you look 20 years ago, when Andy and I spent sufficient time in this sector, you know, you had centralized generation, which people took it as, you know, in the edge of a city, electrons get developed and pumped into a city, and more of that is getting decentralized. That's a big term in our industry right now. There will be decentralized generation going forward. You guys talked about decarbonization. So with decentralization, with decarbonization, and with digitalization, came upon saying, how do we now look at the world's resources and start using it wisely? So the first step was, back in 2000, there was a big push to say, can we just shift from coal-fired generation and go to natural gas? I mean, that was probably one of the biggest conversations happening, and subsequently moving into what we know today, which is large-scale wind, large-scale solar. Now, if you look at everything that we do, and you touched upon a bit, you know, electrification of everything is the next biggest thing that's going to happen. So what that means for us is, you know, we have to think about the whole, the way we deliver power, the way we digitalize stuff, the way we decarbonize in two separate segments. One is what happens behind, inside the house, inside the premise, and what happens at the edge. And the reason why this term was adopted was mainly because the more and more, and I talked about EV, as you put all these resources in, now you have battery storage assets sitting in every home, battery storage assets sitting in every fleet. Then you have to think about solar and storage at every home. Last year, we had a bad year in California because of some rulings that were put in place in terms of compensation schemes for the value that you create when you put it back on the grid. But I think that'll get worked out, as in your paper you mentioned, for 2022. All of these things, listen, there will be a balance in terms of how we look at resource adequacy in this country, and which means you have to use digital technologies to now reach out to these assets rather than building new generation, which costs billions of assets. Just imagine two EVs is equivalent to the size of a home consumption. And if you look at the projection of EVs getting adopted by 2040, we'll reach 70, typical S-curve, it gets saturated. But that's a lot of EVs on the road. And if you look at the charging mechanisms for this, the opportunities are huge. It's great to see what Georgia is doing. We're in Georgia. We're trying to figure out how we can actually, you know, use some of these technologies and put the power in the consumer's hand, which is the biggest thing that the utilities are working on. How do you get consumer engagement on one side so that you can look at demand patterns and load patterns in a different way and push it to when you actually need it, when people come back from their work and fire up their charging their car and all the stuff. There's a lot of cool technologies happening behind the meter, which is one part of the edge, and on the other side, which is on the fringes of the edge, looking at, I think we talked about resiliency and weather patterns and all that stuff that happens, wildfires, you know, how is society, we can react to these things faster and not send data across and actually take some quick actions at the edge, but at the same time use cloud computing, edge computing to our advantage.
Yeah.
A big topic.
It's a lot.
Yeah, I can say it now I always viewed it again really simply. We were the meter nerds, right? So that was the edge, but the edge just stretched beyond, right? So, and the way I like to think about it is, so as you put all this intermittent generation with at the place, so at the central part of the grid, right? So where the electrons get not created, but where the supply chain starts, right? If you no longer have the flexibility there, you're going to need to put the flexibility somewhere else. You're going to put it in, and now that's where your edge technologies, I think, are going to help a lot, right? All that, and you said the word resource adequacy. For those for those not in the utility industry, that probably is sounds like a buzzword. It's not. It's actually a really long old definition, but it is really, it's super important, right?
Yep.
And so I completely agree with that. So I do want to,
Andy, quickly,
want to go into you. Evan. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Cause you're an edge guy too, in your history. Yeah,
we really stacked the panel here.
Yeah.
You know, I promise we're not going to turn it into a net meter.
Thank you.
I just wanted to follow up on what you said, Andy. I don't know who to attribute this quote to, but I heard a great quote at a conference, which was, we used to forecast demand and dispatch supply accordingly. Mm-hmm. Now we're moving to a world where we have to forecast supply and dispatch demand accordingly. So I've just seen, I'll echo what Prasanna said. Really, I've seen a seismic shift in the utility industry and the attitude towards demand side flexibility and demand side management from a couple of decades ago when it was primarily a compliance exercise. Your IRP would say, 50 megawatts or so of DR is cost effective, and you would go get that, and then you would have checked that box. Now everybody, I think, sees the imperative that to maintain affordability and reliability as we integrate all these intermittent resources, you got to go out there and not just open up a program and hope customers come to it. You got to go shake the trees and get these flexible resources enrolled and responsive to either your price signals or your control signals.
Yeah.
So I think maybe where you're going is kind of, where would I invest?
That's where I want to go next, but I love that. So now put that in the context. So you just said, okay, we need all these flexible resources, but it's not just the tech, right? So put your investor hat on. You have to put your EIP hat on. You can put the Evan investor. I just Miguel just found a fund, just created a fund. He wants you to go run that fund. What do you want to invest? Where do you want to write a check?
Personal portfolio theory dictates I should put my money away from that, given my interest in EIP. But that aside, I think it's kind of what I was getting to there. I'm very interested in technologies, typically digital technologies, that can draw out some of those, what let's call them, latent distributed energy resources that aren't responsive, that aren't participating in adding value to the grid. Mm-hmm. There's part of that's a policy challenge, part of it's a technology challenge on the policy side. FERC 2222 is, whenever it gets implemented across the various ISOs, there's a lot of debate around how long it's going to be until we see, material changes in the markets that help distributed energy resources participate more directly. That'll be part of it. But, utilities are going to have to play a role here, too, because I don't know, depends on where you're looking, but maybe half the value stack that a DER can derive from the grid is selling into wholesale markets that 2222 is going to give you access to. The other half is going to be, as you and your neighbors all adopt an EV, we need to manage that load so we don't overload the service transformer that's sitting on the pole outside of your house. Mm. So I think I'm very interested in sort of technologies that can help stack all those value streams, can calculate sort of what's the marginal value backing off a resource at a particular spot, a particular time at the grid, stack that with what does the LMP look like at the wholesale level. And sorry, I know we're diving into a lot of technical buzzword clean tech panel. So I won't, in the interest of time, I won't go into all of that. But I've seen some solutions out there that I think are very interesting in that respect that will send a clear economic signal for customers to volunteer some of the services of their EV or, their industrial loads or whatever to make a more reliable grid.
Yeah, I haven't talked about value stacking in a while. So it was good to hear that. It's good to hear that bouncing around the room again. So, the technologies to make that work, right?
Yeah.
Everyone talks about them. What are you going to do to make it work, right? It's easy to make a model, but not easy to implement. That's fantastic. I have another topic on investing. I'm going to pivot a little bit though, because Miguel, some of the ways that you get some of this technology out isn't just it isn't just investing from the VC standpoint, right? That's one flavor of dollars that get in to create new technology and clean tech. But there's a whole bunch of other ways to do it. And you wrote a beautiful piece, multi-part piece on alternatives to funding green technologies. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about green banking, right? Because I think there's a lot of misnomer. Like, it's a word that we use a lot, but don't really understand what it actually is. I'd love you to explain that a little bit for everybody and enlighten us all. So.
Actually, what Evan said also dovetails really well into it, because when you look at from the VC stack, you like digital solutions in a large part because digital solutions can scale economically in a way that you can get a return. I sat with a traditional investor recently, and he's like, tell me about clean energy. Why would I invest? He's a very traditional VC and a little bit of PE. And I said, why would I invest in this? He's like, where's Moore's Law in energy? Where's Moore's Law in renewable? And, you know, I tried every angle, okay, and I was not getting through because there is no Moore's Law in energy. And I know this, and no matter what argument, I can show him the graph of the price decline of PV over 20 years, and it looks like a Moore's Law kind of structure, but it's not the same thing. And we're not going to have that same thing when we look at renewable energy. So you do have to go find those solutions that still provide the return manage as a venture capitalist. And one of the main reasons why is traditional venture capital funds have a 10-year horizon. In other words, they have to return capital back to their investors in 10 years. Sometimes you get a plus one or two, which you get a little bit extra space. But really, they're deploying money for a period of about 6 years from the close of the fund. And then they've got a little bit of time in order to get that back. So they're going to be very strategic. They're going to invest in things that you can sell. You can find and acquire within anywhere between, let's say, 7 years on the longest front to in most cases, 3 to 4 years, which you'd ideally want to target. That is a very specific type of fund. You have to be able to scale, investment, you have to be able to scale that very, very quickly. If you have hardware, if you're in a highly regulated industry and you're dependent on either the government or large corporate existing entities in order to implement your strategy, if you have to depend on public lands or any kind of public assets, then you're going to struggle to match with the traditional venture capital model. And I'd say in particular, the most of those is if you have hardware. And the main reason being is that hardware is very, very hard to scale, right? And it's, they always say, hardware is hard, and that's true. But the main reason being is that you have only fixed margins, and your potential to sort of spread so rapidly and own a market are very limited because you depend on a lot of existing infrastructure to be able to manufacture, deploy, and maintain those physical assets. In a software company, I can do all that myself. So that is a huge difference. So that's one of the reasons you need these different forms of capital in order for a lot of renewable to work. Because when we talk about sustainable and not just renewable energy, but when we talk about climate adaptive innovation, carbon, low carbon transition, we're really looking at things that are impacting and heavily in the physical environment. And if you're impacting the physical environment, you're doing that with some kind of hardware. So that is where that issue is. So you need a full capital stack. Venture is very well funded. We can talk a little bit about that, but there's a lot of capital that's going to that venture stack, and that's great. It needs to deploy, and I'm sure it will. The other side of it is project finance, which I think one of the best quotes, Rob Day, quoted, said that venture capital does, the first of its kind. Project finance likes to do the 10th. That gap in between the first and the 10th is the trickiest part. It's where almost every innovation that you see on a hardware, renewable energy side or clean tech side dies. It dies in that gap there, or it transitions. A lot of times what you see is innovators will drop the hardware, switch to their software that they developed to operate their hardware, and then they move forward with just a software solution because they can scale that. But green banks have sort of come in to try to bridge that gap in a bit. And what a green bank does, and the reason it can come into that area, that no man's land, is because they use blended capital. Green banks are going to get money from the government agencies, from philanthropic sources, and they're going to blend that with private capital that can come from, let's say, example, banks. Banks have to invest certain amounts of capital in given neighborhoods if they bank in those neighborhoods, because there's a federal requirement for that if they're a regulated bank of certain size. So they're going to put money into these kind of projects because they can do that alongside something like a green bank. The other thing a green bank does is a green bank looks at it and says, how do we reduce the risk of existing investors? If a project finance doesn't want to do something because they haven't seen it proven out. So they want to wait until a 10th project was done. How can I entice them to come earlier? One of the ways I can do it is I can say, hey, we'll guarantee you certain amounts of your loss, right? What are you really worried about? You're worried about, you know, this is too risky. How about we satisfy some of that risk by giving you a guarantee against it? Okay. And that's a way that I can use capital, blended capital, even without deploying it. I can hold that in a bank account and I can still bring private sector capital into the market, because otherwise they wouldn't join if they didn't have that guarantee. Mm-hmm. That guarantee can also do things like reduce interest rates on loans for project finance. So if I'm putting up a new, wind in Georgia, which is not hugely done, and so it would be very sort of new, I'm going to get really expensive financing until I can prove out that that's working. A green bank could come in, provide a guarantee which would reduce the cost of that financing, and then the project might pencil in.
Yeah.
And they can do that for a variety of things. We talked about, you know, with agriculture, the same thing. If you're trying to do things like, if you're trying to transition from a traditional farming to regenerative farming, you're going to lose money for a number of years until you get recertified as regenerative farming. Also, until your crop, until your soil and all of that allows you to market that as a regenerative organic product and get the premium on it. In that transition period, how do you finance that? Well, Green Banks can come in again and do that. So it's a really wide area that they can do. There's one other thing I'd like to say other than guarantees: aggregation. If I'm going to distribute a whole bunch of EV charging, right now I can actually get carbon credits for some of those, right? But if I'm going and I'm putting up 2, 3, 4 EV charging stations, I can't go and figure out how to securitize those or go and sell the offsets of the credits. All of those things are very, very complicated. Yeah. But if somebody stands in the way and aggregates all of those, right, all of the different companies out there, all the different small businesses out there that are putting up EV charging, or let's say forestry, who's doing sustainable forestry and they're generating those carbon credits, it might be really hard for me as one family to go do that. But if somebody can aggregate those, now we can go and find a way to commercially viably go out, sell those offsets, or securitize those in order to provide cash back into the industry. So those are two things. That aggregation component that a green bank can do is really, really important to stimulate the market. So those are the things I think that they do really well, and sort of try to bridge that gap between the VC and the project finance, and there's other sectors, private debt and private equity, that sort of play in there, but green banks will collaborate with them in order to move money in that gap.
Yeah. After reading your pieces, the way I kind of thought about it is just green banking is a set of tools that helps make that financial model that doesn't pencil. Right. And that, I mean, it's in the thing, your thing, your piece brings out is just like the breadth of those tools, right? Which I would encourage everybody who's listening to read, because I just, it totally elucidated what was a fuzzy, murky subject.
And let's say one thing that's really incredible about the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, is they created a $27 billion, but really about $20 billion of it is going to go towards seeding green banks through a couple different mechanisms. But that's really, really important, because they're not picking a sector. They're not picking a technology. They're picking is a theme, right? And the theme is decarbonization. And if you are going to, and then they allow the green banks to go find those solutions locally. So in the case with what I worked on was, how do we take the incredible research that was done by Drawdown Georgia? How do we take that and design specific interventions to accelerate those solutions? Yeah. And that we're allowed to do that because a green bank, and with the way the federal government is pushing down this money, the green banks that are being built are agnostic to any specific sector or solution. And I think that's really, really critical for us to sort of speed up the low carbon transition.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Definitely that's a great thing to read. So that this is supposed to be, a lot of takeaways. Take that one away, audience, please.
And now you know why I'm also sitting away. I talk with my hands.
Michael's been ducking in,
I'll just quickly say an amen. As venture investor, working with the off-takers and the buyers of these projects, we're seeing those problems firsthand every day. You're helping solve two problems, right? One is like the So in some cases, these technologies need some deployment in the field to come down the cost curve. So like the economics can't pencil, and nobody wants to sort of, you know, wear that positive externality being the first one to drive it down the cost curve. And then separately, even if it pro formas out, like you've got all these unknown risks, right? Like, is the project going to be constructed on time? Is it going to run reliably once it's up? And
I mean,
we're doing everything we can, to your point. Like, we stretched our frontier fund life to 15 years, so we can put that capital to work, be patient while all the, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars get poured into R&D, which is what happens in these companies before they see their first dollar of revenue. But it's just not tenable to use venture capital cost of capital to finance these like in the field projects off of a balance sheet. So
thank you for highlighting
that issue.
For venture, if you can be first, you can win a whole market, because again, that's the target of venture. But when you're project financed, no, your returns are still pretty fixed.
Yeah.
So being first never pays off. Sit back and wait, right? So how do you entice them? And I think that's really, really critical. And that's a function of a green bank. Mm-hmm.
So as the audience, you can tell, we could probably talk about this. It could be a 2-hour panel. And I almost want to make it 2 hours, but I know y'all are going to be trying to be around for an hour. And I still have two topics that I want to hit. So I'm just going to give my fellow panelists. We're going to cover our last two topics in about 10 minutes. And then I'll do a little sum up. But for those who are online, we're going to stay for another 15 minutes. We'll probably do a couple of Q&A from the group, as well as we have a couple of other quick hitters. So I just want to do that for the run of the rest of the show here. So We did have a little bit of back and forth again, and back to Evan on, I do want to, you know, this is a super deep topic. So I may even just say, Evan, tee this up, because we're going to have another panel sometime later this year. But, we think a lot about, you know, still if you're in innovation, you're always thinking about the VC world, right? And so obviously we heard a lot of the bad news from 22, 23, pull back, and that's absolutely not what we need in clean tech. We, in our Outlook piece, we were a little bit, I would call, cautiously bullish. Yeah. How do you guys think about this? Give me maybe it's the Evan perspective. You don't have to give the EIP perspective, but let us know a little bit.
All opinions expressed here, Evan opinions.
Yeah.
I keep it really short, Andy, so you guys got it right in the Outlook document, but I'll elaborate a little bit more than that. I mean, you're right. There has been pullback. It all kind of ripples down, right? So the M&A and the IPO markets kind of shut down for the last 2 years, especially as compared to SPAC mania in 2021. That has ripple effects in the private market. So we saw a lot of pullback in venture capital, private equity investing over the last couple of years. And that's true. And there's still a lot of macroeconomic uncertainty going into 2024. I will say there's a lot of silver linings that make me, you know, maybe where you are, or even a little stronger to the bull side on clean tech investing. One is that climate fared better during the downturn. Not immensely better, but if you look at kind of the impact on, you know, total deployments of VC capital, the whole market was down about 40% last year. Climate tech was only down about 30%. There was $41 billion invested in climate last year, which reflects a 23% CAGR from 2020. So you still have a very positive trend if you look at climate tech in isolation. I will say, you know, there's a lot of positive signs around the macroeconomic environment generally going into 2024. We'll save that for a macroeconomic outlook panel, but we expect, and I'm curious for Prasanna's opinion on this, if he cares to voice it, you know, we expect a pickup in M&A and IPO activity in 2024. And lastly, I'll just say the fundamentals are strong. I mean, there's 2,400 corporates around the globe that have made public firm net zero commitments. That's up from, I don't know, zero, like 5 or 6 years ago, or around, you could round to zero. We've got a supportive policy environment in the form of the IRA. Again, we could save for a whole nother discussion.
I'm not going there.
I'm not going to prognosticate on the impacts.
That makes it a 2-hour panel.
I'm only going to say that we're not so scared of, you know, the potential impacts to the policy environment from the elections this year. If you run the scenario analyses, you might get eaten away at the edge on some of the IRA subsidies, but we think a lot of that is safe and resilient to the outcome of the election. So I think in sum, I mean, obviously, we and other investors are going to be a little bit more cautious just given the macroeconomic environment, but there's lots of dry powder, as you called out in the report. There's $30 billion plus of dry powder sitting in funds focused on climate. I just would advise entrepreneurs who are raising in this environment to show, you know, to recognize that we're past ZERP world, zero interest rate policy. You have to show that you can be prudent and efficient with the capital that you're handed. So if you're going to spend $200 million on R&D before you have your first dollar of revenue, you got to show that you can act, that you have a plan that, you know, has clear milestones that show you're building value and working towards success. You're going to iterate fast, and you're not going to waste, you know, your investors' dollars, and you're not going to get ahead of ramping production ahead of demand. So I think just showing that prudency is really the key for folks fundraising environment this year.
So
if I could just add on one thing, I would say for the innovators that are listening and that are out there, if you have a hardware and you're developing hardware, you're building a big piece of something, right? So you're building a brand new, let's say, wind turbine. In a world where there is not free money, you have to start thinking about, okay, if this is a 10 or 15 year cycle before we get this technology fully developed and deployed, how do I, in the interim, find ways to get revenue earlier than that? And avoiding the service revenue issue, because that tends to distract you from your core. But are there pieces of that you can patent and commercialize and license or do anything else? Try to think of that. Try to stage out your investments in these coming years, because there's definitely plenty of money. But that money's coming in and saying, hey, show me that you have plan B, plan C, that this is not just a 10-year roll of the dice. And so I think that's one thing that we're going to see a different approach to with some innovators, in particular in the hardware space.
I think you're right. PV, you're on the other end of the funnel, right? So, you also take place on the investment side, but say a little bit more about what you're looking at from your vantage point.
Yeah, I'll just quickly tie into what you guys said. We remain bullish in the area that we operate. We see a lot of opportunity in grid edge technologies and smart infrastructure are the areas that everybody wants to invest. 21, 22 was bad, 23 was even slightly picking up. But we're very excited about what we see when we look forward, mainly because of a couple things. We see that the whole, you know, investment of 600 billion plus will be a thrust into the economy. The other thing I think you touched upon in your paper as well, GRIP grants are coming in. The government, this is the grid reinvestment,
Good resilience.
It's
good resilience.
Grid resiliency innovation program.
Alphabet soup. Yeah.
And it's important in the context that this is a joint investment. So if you're in our case, if you're a utility doing, you know, forward-looking things, whether it relates to decarbonization mainly and digitalization, you team up with new innovative technologies and you go together to solve a common problem. I think that's an area that we're looking at. So that's important in the context of how we take and build the infrastructure that we need for the next 15 to 20 years, mainly around resiliency. That's the biggest part of it, because you simply can't go and replace every distribution transformer, because today a distribution transformer serves about 3 homes. You got to figure out how you use software, hardware to your advantage to do the kind of balancing that you want, especially on the grid. So I think grid edge technologies and smart infrastructure is an area that we're very bullish about.
Yeah, you can't replace every distribution transformer because also the wait time, the lead time.
You can't get it.
Yeah. So
yes.
But maybe to speak to that, so now we're going to go back to another topic, announcement to production. So again, you got to build a lot of things, right? Yeah. How do we take supply chain that is, you know, backed up on distribution transformers, right? And supercharge that, right? And I think George is doing that, right? So I'm going to come back to Michael and Cynthia on this one. We had a topic called announcement to production, right? So, you know, look, if we want to look at how many big projects got announced in the last 2 years here in Georgia, it's amazing. And I started looking at it, and I was like, wow, this is going to be, stuff's going to be rolling off the assembly lines in this year, right? Not exactly. There's this interim phase, right, where you make the announcement and then things get online, right, because you got to go build infrastructure, all that kind of good stuff. But there's really important stuff that happens in between. And I want to, Cynthia, I'd like you to, again, because you're in the middle and you see this collaboration, what are some of those things in between that we need to think about and maybe even can get involved in?
Yeah, there is a lot of kind of transition once the project is announced to when the ground is broken to when the products roll off the assembly line.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, I'll go back to partnerships. A lot of our role is making sure that those companies have the partners that they need, that they know the people that they need to know in the ecosystem. We do a lot of introductions to business, introducing them to people that have hired in the region, done business in the region so that they could talk to other business leaders. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of community engagement work that happens, both on a local level and also on a business level. So making sure that they're connected with the right companies and the right customers potentially, and making sure that they're talking to the community. And we work as a team with all of the other chambers that are in the region. So we are like an umbrella, and the local chambers come in and take a huge role in that place. And Georgia Power also has a huge role in that as well, making sure that they're getting all the power needs that they have, making sure that the transformers are, like we talked about, are in place, giving kind of interim power in the meantime. And then a whole other issue and opportunity that we've been blessed with is the creation of the jobs. Yes. So we're building an entire workforce ecosystem. Quick Start is a GDEC program, mm-hmm. Georgia Department of Economic Development. It's one of the best workforce programs in the whole country.
And a lot older than people think, right?
It's been around for years, like 20 years, I think. I might be wrong on that. It might be 15. But they're working
40 plus.
Yeah,
there
we go.
It started out from textiles, right? Okay. So I mean, it's been from farming to textiles, right? So there's a lot of, it's got a very deep history. Yeah.
And they're building workforce programs that are specifically focused on solar. Like, you know, Qcells is taking the Dalton carpet workforce and totally retraining them, right? And so, you know, Rivian is doing a lot of work with the community around sustainability and water and getting to know them. And then they meet with the partners in the ecosystem. Hyundai joined with Georgia Tech to launch an innovation, battery innovation lab here. So those are all the things. And I think a lot of the reason I mentioned earlier that people come to Atlanta and come to Georgia is there is that collaborative spirit. But all that stuff starts happening. We talk about it all when they decide to come here, and then we put it all into action once they announce and make sure that they have all the resources that they need and connect with who they want. But it's definitely not just the chambers, the whole community, and all of the local communities and all the local chambers, and of course Georgia Power that steps up and really helps make sure that they have everything that they need. But it's a lot of work.
Yeah,
it's definitely a lot of and you're trying to make sure that they are known. I mean, the Atlanta, we sit around the table, you know, and solve problems, and everybody opens their Rolodex. And we want to make sure that those new companies and those new additions to the region have that visibility and have that warmth and openness with all the other companies there, because, and organizations, because it really is what makes the difference.
Your job doesn't end when the announcement happens.
Oh, no. Mine, being on the ecosystem expansion, that's kind of where mine begins. I'm, you know, trying to make sure they have what they need. The Sherpa.
I want to give Michael one. Maybe you get the last framed up question and keep it. I'll keep it quick because I got it. We're right at one.
Yeah.
So Drawdown. Drawdown. The Business Compact not only addresses companies that are headquartered here, but you also have, as you mentioned, Kia, right? Not headquartered here, but how do you engage with some of the companies that are coming here to manufacture?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we, two ways,
yeah.
And I'll try to keep this really concise.
Yeah.
One is through recruitment. So
yeah.
In terms of getting companies, making them aware of the compact and seeing the benefits for it.
Yeah.
If by being part of the compact, that can help accelerate that process that Cynthia just described, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
The other way to do it is through a community of practice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the other activity areas that we're building to share lessons learned. How do we, you know, what are some of the lessons learned? For example, we had, we do a series of webinars, and we had Meta came in and talked about, you know, how they got for their data centers, how they got some of their solar energy projects underway.
Yeah.
And there was a ton of lessons learned there for other compact members. So I'd say it's twofold. It's one, it's creating that community within the existing sort of companies, but then also, you know, as initiatives grow out of the compact, we need to make sure we're engaging the players that are most instrumental in moving those particular issues or initiatives forward.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's a new entrant as opposed to an existing company that's here in the state.
Yeah. No, that's a perfect sum up. I mean, and it goes back to collaboration, right? It goes back
it does.
To the very first thing we started in. So this all comes around in a big circle. So now my job as moderator is to tie it in a circle so that everyone can get off to their 1 o'clock calls. Real quick, I'm going to keep the summary super short. if you do want to hang on, please hang on. Look, I just summed up one of my points was I think everyone here talked about collaboration in some way. I think we all use that word. I think clean tech is one of those places where that is, it's very unique. Again, it's not one technology. Any one technology that has to get deployed requires many different, you know, system integrators, elements to make sure that technology actually works, right? So I think collaboration is critical. We've heard it many times here. Miguel, you almost stole my one of my sum up points, which is great. I don't even mind it. So for innovators who are in this space, you know, we talked about the, you know, Evan started with the 5.5 gigawatts from one company, you know, of deals, right? I started in the storage industry when it was only 250 megawatts, and we were all chasing that 5 years down the road, right? So innovators, Miguel was completely right. You have to have a plan, and it has to be long, and you have to be very open. And I think VCs are much more open now in talking about those long plans and being very realistic about it, because we're not having clean tech 1.0 problems again, right? And then lastly, maybe it's a transition out of VC. We just talked about that a little bit. You know, it's not just VC, right? You know, the investment across you know, the life of these technologies is immense, and we do need other types of funds to de-risk that. And that's a place where it's very hot right now. And I think us as Georgians need to take this very seriously and try to take advantage of it, because it can really push our state forward. So that's my quick summary. I thank you all for joining. I thank all my panelists, and we will hang on here and do some questions. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks everybody for joining.
Great conversation.
Absolutely.
Great. I'll just read a couple of questions we had.
Awesome.
For people on, just type them into the Q&A. We can get started. Michael, more just for clarification, people were wondering, you talked about 63 companies in the compact. Those aren't all clean energy companies. Maybe if you can talk more about the types of companies that join. And then I know we have a lot of people representing companies. How can they learn more and get involved in the compact?
I'll start with the second one first. So the easiest way to get involved is to either reach out to me or David Eady. And I also want to acknowledge David Eady and Allison Bridges at our center have just done an amazing job with the compact. So they're reaching out to them, and we can provide that information somehow. Yep. And then in terms of the compact, yeah, we have, it's not all about energy, although of course that's a key topic. We have a number of companies, excuse me, that represent a variety of sectors, including ag, including forestry, including, well, I guess it's energy. We have law firms, we have real estate firms as well. So we have consultants. So it really does, you know, it's quite a range of companies that are currently represented. We have Anthem, we have healthcare. What I would suggest is if we, you know, are always looking for other companies that are going to help that make this ecosystem work. So if you work for a company that you think, you know, there might be an interest in being part of this, we'd love to have that engagement.
Great. And we did, I think we shared LinkedIn profiles with people join, so they can, you know, please reach out to Michael directly, or the website has a tremendous amount of information as well. So good. Another question. This is from Jay Runner. This is maybe more for the panel, maybe a little bit more for Cynthia, but he was asking, is there an organization within Georgia that identifies opportunities that are available for sustainable development? You know, there are a lot of companies are looking for opportunities to develop things like virtual power plants, sustainable campuses, you know, through bringing all these technologies together. What are good resources for companies seeking those types of opportunities?
You mean to get to know more about the region?
Yes, the region and where those opportunities may be.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the chamber is a good place to start our economic development. And then I mentioned the local counties and the Chamber of Commerce for each local organization is a great place to start as well. ARC has a ton of information on kind of initiatives and grants that are happening in the area.
I'd also add GFO, Georgia Environment Finance Authority. That's also a great repository for just knowing what's happening on the ground. And
It may be a little bit tangential, but it just occurred to me that the other thing that the drawdown researchers are continuing to do is create a visualization of where carbon emissions are across the state, not only where they are, like by county, but then also tracking what solutions are actually mitigating that carbon. So that's another way of, at least from a physical standpoint, of understanding where the innovation needs to be applied. Yeah.
Good. That's all the, I think that's all the questions we had. So I don't know.
Andy, I'll just add.
Yes, there we go. Take our time.
We are starting, Jonathan's helping me with this. We're trying to create an ecosystem report for the region, a clean tech ecosystem report, which will answer a lot of these questions and kind of set a baseline of where are we, what kind of, you know, companies do we have here, who's here, what kind of industries are here, and then what jobs have been created. I would love to give little glimpse of how much carbon has the region helped cut down long haul. I don't know if that's possible, but anyway, we're starting, Jonathan's helping with this, on an ecosystem report. So hopefully we'll be able to have some more information about that and tax partner on it, as well at the chamber. Q4, fingers crossed, but it'll address all those kinds of questions and any feedback on what an ecosystem like that could answer, a report could answer, is appreciated from everyone at this table. And on the line.
You heard it here first, guys. Everyone. Q4. It's now in the public domain. Watch out. We got a lot of work to do. All right. So I'll go to the couple of quick fire questions here to close us out. And we got about 7 minutes. We're good. 5 minutes. Jonathan, give me five. All right. So based on our conversation today, what do you guys think we may have underestimated or overestimated in our write-up? And again, I like criticism, so keep it quick because it'll make it hurt less. So, Michael, PV, you want to start? Yeah.
Surprisingly, we didn't talk about water in the report. I think it's the next biggest problem that our country faces in the globe. Just as a statistic, there's 2.2 million pipes underground. They are on an average 45 years old. It's older than the grid in some cases. And there's about 25% of them leak.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the statistic is like something like 30% of treated water gets lost.
Wow.
And we are very interested in water as an organization, because it mirrors everything that we do on the grid edge and smart infrastructure with the same technologies, believe it or not, and figuring out ways to apply that and, you know, seek out how we can solve this together as a country. And it requires collaboration, it requires a large ecosystem. The same thing continues, and water is even more complicated, because from a ratio point of view, there's 55,000 water utilities in this country compared to roughly 3,000 national utilities.
Wow.
Yeah, because every little small town has their own
water
utility. So it's a serious problem growing. And all the things you talk about, I mean, you can actually take the five pillars you created and you can actually apply it to it.
Yeah.
Not to give you any more work.
we need the work.
So it's a really important piece of work from a sustainability point of view.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great.
Cool. What else?
The only thing I would say is, we touched on it a little bit, is that it's, you really do have to take into account how long development takes on this. And a lot of people hear announcements and we get all excited about it. And it just takes so long for those to actually become the jobs that really matter, or the innovations at scale that really matter. The decarbonization takes a really long time to happen. I think we need to be really realistic to that one. Big announcements are critical. They're actually fuel in the pipe, and they get the fire started, all of that. But we have to also be realistic. I think one of the things that actually happened, and I raised my first one in 2010, so you can imagine 2011 hurt like hell. One of the things that happened there is there was this idea that, oh, we just flipped a switch and it's over. And we just have to be a lot more realistic. These are big projects that take a very long time for the results to actually compute. And so we need to sort of take that in stride and say, okay, let's keep developing. One of the eggs I always look at is the biotech investors are probably, to me, the ones that we should relate back to the most, because they've been doing this for a really long time. And they've figured out how to sort of parse their enthusiasm, you know, beyond, oh, we patented a molecule, to, oh, we just had stage one results, you know, stage two. So this is a really, and it can be decades. And I think that's a great analogy for us to take into account. Don't minimize the great victories, but at the same time, you know, prepare to hang on for a long time.
Go ahead.
I was just going to add that I think one of the things that we, at least in terms of the conversation that we maybe didn't have time to get into, is, you know, how do we make sure that this transition is inclusive. And when I say inclusive, inclusivity for inclusivity's sake, but also inclusivity for the sake of innovation, right? I mean, Atlanta consistently ranks as the highest income disparity in the country. We have a solar workforce that is, you know, 80% white males. I got nothing against white males. I am one. But we, you know, there's an opportunity. Then we talk about the shortages and the workforce needs that we have for all of these technologies to be deployed and scaled. So how do we make sure that that workforce is being trained up and, yeah. and has increased opportunity? So that'd be one topic.
Yeah.
That's really
a great one. I think we didn't talk enough about bananas. And I don't mean the fruit. I mean the acronym, which is build absolutely nothing near anyone anytime soon. And it's not a sentiment that you hear a lot. It's not a sentiment that you hear a lot about the big factories that are coming to Georgia that are going to create a lot of new jobs, have a lot of local benefits in the community. But it's an increasingly pernicious trend for citing things like wind and solar assets. There's increasing movement of, you know, towards local ordinances to prevent siting those things nearby. Certainly it's going to plague innovation in the nuclear industry if SMRs and Gen 4 reactors begin to commercialize. And it's really, really a problem in citing linear assets. And we have to cite a lot of linear assets across all segments of clean tech to affect this transition. We need a lot more transmission lines to bring renewables to load. If we're going to build a hydrogen economy, we need a lot of dedicated pipelines to bring hydrogen from the electrolyzers next to the renewables to where it's going to be consumed.
We need to rebuild our water infrastructure at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. Water infrastructure and carbon, right? Yeah. If we're going to build a carbon management economy where we're capturing and sequestering, we got to move those carbon molecules around. And there's a lot of challenges right now with securing new rights of way for those kinds of assets.
I would say workforce. I mean, Michael talked on it a little bit, but workforce from, we have an exact beautiful opportunity to diversify the clean tech ecosystem, which it desperately needs. Yeah, it does. And I feel like my son is an apprentice at EnviroSpark, electrician apprentice, and I feel like our generation kind of gave the trade schools a little bit of a cold shoulder. And so I think that a lot of it is going to be making trade cool again and making sure that those, talent of the future knows about what's happening. We do a lot of that work in at the MAC. One of our biggest focuses this year is attracting talent to the region because we have those 16,000 plus jobs that have been created, and we need to make sure that we are training both the rising talent and the youth talent to do those, but also retraining like the Dalton carpet workers and taking those. We have such income disparities in Atlanta across the board. And this is a way that we could help those organizations and help those underserved communities find really, really, really great careers that are purpose-filled and helping save the world and helping them make a better life for them and their family. So, and then also helping the state move forward and kind of innovate. So
can I just workforce together? Because I think actually one of the ways you win over the public is by letting them see that there's jobs along with this, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've seen some with Rivian and the build out there. They've had to go and make that argument. These are jobs, like these are going to be good jobs, but people haven't quite seen it yet. But the more we get inclusive in that workforce, I think the less NIMBYism we're going to have. To some extent, it's never going to go away.
I'll say that I was at a ribbon cutting recently for EnviroSpark. They did EV chargers for 3 nonprofits, and they invited their installation team to the ribbon cutting. And I thought, this is what we need to be doing, right? Like, let's include the people that are doing the work and doing the installation so that they feel glorified and appreciated and things along that line. I just thought it was really interesting and a really great touch, and something that if we started doing more things like that, recognizing those installation teams and the people that really make it happen, then that we might go a long way towards kind of enticing more workforce and more celebration of those jobs.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.